Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Throughout history, many brave people have put their lives on the line and sacrificed much in the name of justice and peace. We all know the household names like Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King Jr., and Desmond Tutu. There are many, many more not so famous, but still making a tremendous difference in the lives of many, many people around the world, like Kathy Kelly. She's the founder of an organisation called Voices for Creative Nonviolence and is one of the most respected leaders in the American peace movement. She's worked in war zones around the world, including places like Nicaragua, Iraq, Afghanistan. She's been arrested more than 60 times and 3 times has been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. Kathy Kelly is visiting Australia with the peace organisation Pace Bene, which means peace and all good. And I'm honoured to say that Kathy Kelly joins us now on Open House. Kathy, welcome.
Well, thank you, Lee. It's great to be here.
It's a great honour to have you here. Reading your biography, it seems the seeds for a life of peace activism were planted very early on in your life.
You know, I grew up in an immigrant area of Chicago on the southwest side. And maybe we were upper lower class or lower middle class, but the only professionals we saw really were the nuns. These were religious women wearing the long habit. And they did have a tremendous impact on me. I think maybe one of the most important things they taught us was that they never showed any interest in acquiring personal wealth. They worked without a salary. They did good works. I mean, they weren't shuffling papers meaninglessly or certainly weren't planning or helping to create wars. They were cheerful most of the time in my experience, but that very important factor that they weren't trying at all to acquire personal wealth. And I think we were a generation of kids who would never do anything that would cross the nuns. If sister said, you did it. That we didn't do what sister did so very well in my generation. I think there's been a great interest in, you know, buffering one's life with a lot of belongings and financial security and not so much of that reveling in sharing and service.
Yes. You read extensively the writings of Martin Luther King Jr. How did he impact on your life?
Well, you know, I did grow up in a quite racist area of Chicago. And to see the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King walking arm in arm with a medical doctor, his name was Quentin Young. He's legend now for saying everybody in, nobody out. And to know very clearly he was being vilified on my block amongst, honestly, not so much amongst my own family. My parents were immigrants, my mother from Ireland. But there were many people who wanted to see him dead. Mm. And it seemed to me that he was living out the teachings of Jesus in such an accessible, clear way. And to this day, I'm so grateful to have been on the planet at the same time that he was, and to be able to, you know, hold on to his speeches and look at what he had to say in the speech that he gave in the Riverside Church, you know, asking us to try to see how we're seen, yes, by our adversaries.
It was and has been such a transformative time if you look at the days before that and look at where we are now.
Well, surely. And I actually saw in my own neighborhood that when Bull Connor, who was a sort of notorious sheriff in the South and was telling his police people to aim fire hoses at children and sick dogs, barking dogs on the children, when people saw that, and in a sense there was a choice making, whose side are you on? Do you want to be on the side of people that will attack children with dogs and fire hoses? Or do you want to be on the side that's more in line with what you've been taught all your life long?
At what point in your life and why did this happen? Was it that you moved into a degree of activism rather than sitting on the sidelines as an albeit interested and somewhat connected observer, but to take that step to be an activist? How did that happen?
Well, you know, I don't think I could have any longer sung a very pious and likable song. The verses were, "Our God hears the cry of the poor." I couldn't sing that and realize that I was living in Hyde Park in Chicago, a very well-endowed neighborhood. I was working on a master's degree in theology at the time. And I didn't see any poor people, and I wouldn't. And so I wasn't complaining, but I made that very clear to a professor whom I deeply, deeply admired. And as he walked away from the conversation, he just sort of said offhandedly over his shoulder, "Well, Kathleen, why don't you go up to that soup kitchen on the north side?" And I thought, well, of course he's right. And I took the train up to the north side and very timidly stuck my hand between iron grates to knock on a glass door, wondering, what am I doing? And then by the time I was a half hour into cutting up onions and potatoes, I realized, well, this is exactly where I want to be. And
I'm so struck so often in the wonderful people I speak with on Open House whose lives are changed by such a simple comment.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I was so indebted, really, because it's cliche, but the grass just hasn't looked greener elsewhere than to be deeply, closely aligned with people who are trying to put their lives in accord with what they believe.
Yes. So you move from the soup kitchen in your 20s to in your 30s. You're taking quite serious steps of activism, traveling to places like Nicaragua for peaceful protests, and doing something you called war tax refusal. Can you explain that to us?
Well, I was teaching at a Jesuit school, and I was given a lot of privilege to bring in issues related to nuclear disarmament. It was during the height of the Cold War still. And I reached a point where I didn't think I any longer could talk to my students about issues related to ending wars and weaning ourselves off of weapon systems, and then turn around and take a third of the income, maybe, you know, close to a half of the income that was paid to me through their parents' hard-earned tuition money, and turn that over to paying for wars. So I went to the Jesuit employers, and I said, would it be okay with you if I lowered my salary beneath the taxable income? And they said, well.
They said, what?
Okay, dear, if that's what you really want.
Wow.
So they were paying me less than the cleaning people, really. But I felt such relief, and eventually.
You weren't alone in that.
No. There were quite a few of us in the Chicago area who were doing that. And in some cases, we were able to take the income that we didn't take as our salary and have some influence on where it could go to. I paid tuition for several students who wouldn't have otherwise been able to go to this kind of posh school. And I was able to donate money to the soup kitchen and the shelter. And we pooled our money, some of us, to help keep American Friends Service Committee activities going for refugees who'd been coming to our city from Central America. So I was kind of like Lady Bountiful for a while, really. Those days are over.
Yes.
And it's completely against the law because I wouldn't file at the end of the year. You're supposed to
give a tax return.
Yeah. And then another means of doing it has been to, which I haven't done in a long time, but I have done it, is to claim extra allowances on the W-4 form that we're given. Very close mentor and friend Carl Meyer one time claimed the entire population of Vietnam as allowances that he should be conscious of. So,
creative accounting.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
In the 80s, you were part of an event called the Missouri Peace Planting. You actually trespassed on a nuclear missile launch site to plant corn, and then you were arrested. Tell us about that event.
You know, it was such a beautiful morning. The mist was rising from the ground and the birds were chirping and my heart finally stopped pounding. And all of a sudden, this vehicle came speeding down the road and it skidded to a stop. And out came four men in full military garb, the camouflage and the helmets and boots and walkie-talkies. And I was afraid that they'd ask me to climb the fence in front of them. And I was very, very awkward about that. So I was kind of relieved that they had the key and they opened it. And we had planted corn. Each of us went to a different site. And
why was that?
Well, we believed that land was meant to grow corn and wheat and not to harbor weapons of mass destruction. And I had moved from this wealthier school to teaching kids in my own neighborhood who were part of two different gangs. And honestly, very few of them survived their teenage years. And I thought, well, kids can't live through their teenage years. And we're pampering, we're babying these nuclear weapons that could blow us all to smithereens. So I just so much remember three soldiers took off, maybe to see what the manual says to do next. And the one that they left with me had a gun aimed to my head. I was kneeling on the ground and I was handcuffed. And I started to tell him a little bit about, I didn't turn around, I just looked straight forward, but I told him a bit of what I've just told you. And then I asked him, do you think the corn will grow? And he answered, I don't know, ma'am, but I sure hope so. So then I asked him.
At least he knew what you were talking about.
Yeah. And I said, would you like to say a prayer? Yes, ma'am. And there's an easily memorized prayer we call the prayer of St. Francis. Lord, make me a channel of your peace. Where there is darkness, let me sow light. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is sadness, joy. And I finished that prayer out, and he said, amen. And then he asked me, ma'am, would you like a drink of water? And I was so thirsty. And I said, yes, please. And then he said to me, ma'am, would you please tip your head back? And I can still feel that water dribbling down my chin. He poured water down my throat. And I thought that soldier did an act of kindness for a complete stranger. And I always wanted to remember him.
What an amazing moment of engagement. Although you end up 9 months in a maximum security prison for that.
Well, that's true. I was a bit relieved. I was facing a potential sentence of 30 months. You know, as soon as they would let us go, we'd go right back out to the missile silo sites and plant more corn. So we were facing a much more severe time. I learned a lot in that 9 months of time. It's very difficult to understand the war against the impoverished people in the United States, especially if you haven't yourself been afflicted by hunger and by concern for how you're going to make ends meet. And the drug availability is high, but it's also the only economic stake that a lot of people have in the community. I don't approve of people, you know, getting involved in the drug trade, and their lives are ruined many times. But when they come to the prisons, many are sort of treated mercilessly, and they're separated for such long, long stretches from their children, from their loved ones, and it's extremely difficult punishment. And it's hard to understand that, I think, if you go in as a chaplain or if you go in as a guard or as a social worker, as well as you can understand if you're sitting on the bunk next to a woman and saying you're sorry, you're so very sorry, while she's weeping because she's been separated from her children so long she doesn't think they'll remember what she looks like.
Or... Sure, there's a world of difference. On Open House, we're with three times Nobel Peace Prize nominee, Kathy Kelly, who's in Australia at the moment. That wasn't actually the first time she was arrested. I'll ask her about that in just a moment. Kathy, I want to take you into the war zones that you've been involved with around the world, that you've seen: Nicaragua, Iraq, Egypt, Lebanon, Gaza Strip. You've negotiated with the Israeli Defence Force, which we'll get to in just a moment. You've been living with the families under fire there. What is it, in practical terms, you aim to achieve when you go behind the military lines into these danger zones?
Well, we have an understanding that where you stand determines what you see. I'm directly quoting something that a barrister and minister from Perth, Australia, had said to me several times when we were in Iraq during times of severe horrible bombardment. Mm. And often, especially when a war is going on and a country is trying to rally its population to say, yes, this is a good idea, you're not encouraged to see the people, particularly the civilians, the children, the grandmother, the women, who can't escape and who are caught in the crosshairs in the tremendous anxiety and fear and tension if they do survive. So when you go into a war zone wanting to listen and record and give voice to that reality, I think it's, and when you don't have an editor or a deadline, you've got much more flexibility and resilience just to be able to listen and stay with people for weeks and months. And after the war, the bombing war stops, to walk out into the villages and examine the devastation.
All we ever see on the television are the pictures of that. Mm. But can you tell us what it's like in real life, what those people go through during those times of severe bombardment, war?
Well, I was with many families in a five-story building called the Burj Al Fanar Hotel in Baghdad during the Shock and Awe bombing. And I remember staying up late at night, kind of taking shifts with two little girls who were the children of the night desk clerk and his wife and the two children had moved into the hotel. And I loved those two little girls, Milada and Zainab. And one of them, Milada, she was so inventive. She'd point her finger in the air and she'd make an arc with it and she'd scream out the word for airplane, tiara, tiara. And then she'd make a fist and she'd, with her clenched fist, strike herself on the heart and fall back in my arms as though she'd been killed. And then she'd come back to life again. Well, in a way, I thought this was psychologically not a bad idea for her to play this game. But her mother, of course, was very, very worried. She said, never before did she play games like this. And her other one was she couldn't wait to get her hands on a flashlight. And I'd try to get her to play Tinkerbell or, you know, make shadow shows on the wall. But she wanted to use it as a gun that she would first aim at her mother, and at her sister, and then her new big friend. And the mother really didn't like that game. But again, she could invent these imitations of war and then have the relief of everyone being okay. When I was in Gaza during the Operation Cast Lead, I remember a mother feeling so overwhelmed by the relief the day the ceasefire was called. She sank into a chair. She put the back of her hand on her forehead. And she said, "Can you imagine? This is the first time I breathe, I really breathe, in all these 22 days. And that so represented what I'd heard from other mothers once in a woman's hospital room. She was so wounded and injured by white phosphorus burns, and I don't think she knew the full extent of how much loss she had sustained. And I went to her home in Al-Atatra. She was still in the hospital, and I felt like we couldn't really try to tell her story because who knew? Maybe she was having nightmares. I almost hoped that it was something that was beyond the reality, but the reality was really beyond what she knew. And written on the wall of her home that had been ransacked, I mean, and I understand it in some ways. You know, if the soldiers are going to occupy a house and hers was a little higher than the others and they wanted to be able to see in case there were attacks, well, you don't want it to be booby-trapped, so you rip open every mattress and you empty all the drawers and you trash the closets and you turn over all the furniture. And written on the wall in green spray paint were these words, Min Jesh Israelin Nachnu Ansifa, from the Israeli military, we're sorry. Now, I can't know what to make of that.
No.
But I do know that a lot of people in my country weren't sorry. They weren't even slightly aware. And we paid for so many of the Apache helicopters and the F-16 fighter planes and the 500-pound bombs and the Hellfire missiles and even the white phosphorus. And, you know, if you were going to ever build a tunnel that would bring all those materials into Israel for the Israeli military from the United States, your tunnel would have to be the size of the Grand Canyon in the United States. It'd be huge.
Yes. You've also negotiated with the renowned Israeli Defense Force. Tell us about that experience.
We had thought that it would be important to go into the Jenin camp. This was a place where refugees had been twice displaced, sometimes three times. And there was an operation that the Israelis launched, which was directly hitting civilian homes and rounding up civilians and imprisoning them and sometimes even using them as human shields. And we were hearing about it, but it wasn't clear. You know, journalists couldn't get in. So we talked our way in. We walked about a 13-mile distance with a pillowcase that we borrowed from a woman's home and a broom pole. And, you know, the Israelis would drive past us and say, "You can't be here. You can't be here." And so one of us would talk about scripture and the other would talk about philosophy. And I talked about novels that had been very meaningful to me by Israeli authors. And I'm kind of amazed to remember it, but eventually one of the soldiers would always kind of break and say, "Well, if you cross through those two tomato fields and take a right through that onion field, you can get in." And it was like a Monty Python, so okay, and we'd take off. So we actually got into the Jenin camp while it was still under attack. And it was important. I mean, there was one point where one family was trying to feed their paralyzed grandmother out through an aperture in a wrecked building. And at first there were some media covering it, and then there were shots fired, and immediately the media just dispersed. And we were left trying to figure out how could we help this woman. So we said, okay, we'll take her to the hospital. And My two friends were carrying her like a sack of potatoes. She was terrified.
Yes.
And so they said, Kathy, run and get a stretcher. And I said, where? And they said, that way. Didn't you see we passed the Red Cross building? And so I took off running, and three Israeli soldiers were coming toward me with their guns out. Well, thank goodness for me having been a high school study teacher. I just said, put those guns down now and tell me where the hospital entrance is. Which door will be open?
Because a lot of those soldiers are very young.
They were so young.
Yes.
And they put the guns right down. And I said, well, ma'am, not that door, that one. Ooh. And I thanked them very much. And I'm, you know, peeling off running to get the stretcher. I come back with the stretcher on my head because the hospital personnel, who would have wanted so much to come out and assist this woman, didn't dare. They were Palestinians. And the soldiers wouldn't have put the guns down for them. So I bought the stretcher back, and I looked, and there was my friend Jeff, big, tall fellow, kneeling over the grandmother with his blue passport, American passport, in the air. He's waving it, and he was trying to protect her from a second floor. The soldiers were lining plates and glasses down on this terrified old woman. Why does this happen? Well, I think when we train our soldiers to believe the exact opposite of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's teachings, that these aren't human beings, that they're all a threat to ourselves and our families, then you're just trying to eradicate, to eliminate. But it's not true. The truth is the same blood flows through all our bodies, and we know that at a deep, at a very basic level. And I think if we can disclose it to ourselves, sometimes by telling the truth about war, then there's a much greater possibility that we'll grow up and get rid of these wars.
Teachings of Martin Luther King Jr., teachings of Jesus. As I said at the top, you've been arrested more than 60 times. You've spent your fair share of your life behind prison bars. Do you remember the first time?
Well, the President Jimmy Carter had reinstated draft registration, and a number of us felt that it wasn't fair to take the youngest who haven't had a chance to experience their lives and try to goad them into being ready to go off to war zones. And so we thought we should sing songs in the post office so that they could identify people that would be there in solidarity with them if they chose not to register, which would have been a big, brave step. And so I was arrested for doing that. But, you know, some of your listeners in across Australia might be familiar with the Abu Ghraib story when the those photos were first released. I was in prison at that time. And women in the prison, I didn't know a thing about it. They came running to get me, and they said, oh, girl, you got to see what's on TV. And I went with them, and I expected, you know, a hurricane or something like that. And I saw the pictures, the man on the milk crate, the man on the hooded man, the man in the leash, and the pyramid, and the women were crying, and I thought maybe they're just identifying so much with these prisoners, but I realized that actually they were feeling deep patriotism. One of them said to me, what's happening to our country? And another asked, well, what can we do about it? And I said, well, maybe not too much. We're in prison. And, you know, they went that afternoon to the warden, and they asked for permission to form a circle on the oval track when the sun went up and when the sun came down so that they could pray for their country and for the people at war and for the people bearing the brunt of war. And those prayers just stay with me always. Women holding hands. At first there were 12. There were 80 by the time I left the prison, out on that oval track, praying, Lord, I just want to pray for our kids. You know how we, all of us, feel so sad for what's happened to our kids, but I also pray for the kids of all the soldiers that are over there in Iraq, because we know they must miss their moms and dads. And praying for the people in Iraq, praying for the children, praying for forgiveness, praying for the prison guards and for their children.
Wow. You've been traveling with some of the young men from the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers. I'd like you to tell us, if you could, the story of Abdullahi.
Do you know, he's such a hard worker. Two or three times a month, he gets up at 2 a.m, gets on a donkey, rides up the mountainside 6 hours to get scrub brush and twigs that he can then take a 6-hour ride back with sometimes, no doubt, hugging the donkey because of the icy roads are cold, and then unload his firewood and put that on the rooftop, and then go out and harvest potatoes or plant potatoes, and then by candlelight try to study. And his English gets better every week. Your listeners could listen to him if you go online to globaldaysoflistening.com. Okay. On October 21st, there will be a 21st. There will be a time to hear these young people speak through translation from their coordinator. But Abdullah is welcoming and friendly, and his father was killed by the Taliban at age 2. His older brother Hamadjan carried him on his shoulders away, just with an immediate run for your life, a situation where the family had to split in different directions after a Taliban attack. And, the kids don't really know how old they are, maybe 15, 16. They don't do the birth certificate things. But he's now, 13 years or 14 years later, someone who would have every reason to say, the Taliban killed my father, they displaced my family for years, my mother is to this day filled with remorse, I want revenge. And he's not saying that. He's instead asking us to bring more visuals and copies of the writings of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King.
Why does he not pursue vengeance?
Yeah, they formed a group called the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers, and they've been together for 4 years, and they draw a lot of strength from each other and from the person who has coordinated their work. He's a medical doctor from Singapore, a real visionary. And they've seen what results from killing and hatred and violence, and they think the spiral will just continue on.
Your faith has undergirded so much of your life and work. You're from the Catholic worker tradition. Can you tell us about that movement?
During the Depression, a woman who was a fine journalist, Dorothy Day, was approached by a French peasant philosopher, and Peter Morin kept pestering her, really, saying, well, you shouldn't just talk about the social action and fulfilling duties of caring. Why don't you do something? Why don't you start a soup kitchen? And so she took her salary and put some money down to start a storefront soup kitchen, which eventually became a house of hospitality. And the socialists and communists were selling something called a newspaper, called the Communist Worker, or the Daily Worker. And so she'd go down with the Catholic Worker, and they'd sell that for a penny a copy. And it would communicate these ideas that weren't really so much revolutionary if you situate them in the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth and the prophetic teachings that said, is not this the fast that I desire, that you share your bread with the homeless poor and don't turn your back on those in need.
Yes.
But it also was a movement imbued with pacifism, the idea that we have a responsibility to claim our right not to kill and not to loan ourselves to be killed or to kill, and to give support, all manner of support, for those who want to refuse to be in support of war or creating weapons or using weapons. So she stuck by that during World War II, even after the atomic blasts of Hiroshima. She said, no, that was a wrongful thing to do. That's everything has changed, I guess it said in Life magazine, except the individual conscience against the atomic bomb. So they wouldn't take shelter during the nuclear air raid practice drills, and they'd get arrested for that. And she stood by Cesar Chavez and the farm workers. But she kept these houses of hospitality going, never moving away from the cares and concerns of the poorest people. She really helped a whole generation, and now several successive generations,
yes,
see that it's possible, and it's very attractive to let the most impoverished be our top priority, and then it's a lot easier to make decisions.
And the teachings of Jesus that inform and undergird and motivate you in your work and life are what?
Cross those borders. Don't be afraid. I think that Jesus sent his disciples so deliberately, destitute themselves, to cross borders and to invite people into a way of healing the divisions in their society by loving, by saying, I will share what I have with you. We won't turn anybody away, and especially trying to break down the borders whenever anybody was presumed to be an outcast or deserving of punishment. So Jesus and his disciples didn't die of old age except for one, and all of them went to prison except for one.
Yes. Kathy Kelly, I said at the top what an honour it was to meet you.
Well, thank you,
and now talk with you.
It's been great to be with you.
Great treat. Time went by quickly.
Thank
you so much. Kathy's doing a number of talks around the country while she's here, including lectures in Sydney this Monday and Wednesday night. For details, you can go to www.kathykellytour.org and click on the Events in Your State tab, and we'll post them on our Open House Community Facebook page. Kathy, once again, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. We'll be so pleased if people can come to the Uniting Church on Monday night.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology Solutions. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.